And I quite like it, actually, with the tables laid out like this. It's, you know, it's a different way of doing church on Sunday morning, but there's absolutely nothing wrong with it, and it seems good to me. But anyway, we're going to have a look at a passage in the book of Acts together this morning, and we're going to look at four people. We'll make time to look at four people. We're going to look at four people, and we're going to see how each of those four people, we're going to learn a bit of a lesson about what happened to them when they encountered the gospel and the effect that it had on them. And why four people, you say? Well, it's partly because there's four people in the passage, but partly because, you know, it might be that the first person I talk about doesn't kind of relate to where you are in your spiritual journey, but maybe the second does, and if the second doesn't, then maybe the third will. So as we go through, then we can see and find out what we can learn from each of these people. We're in Acts chapter 9, and if you want to turn to it, then you can. If not, then you can listen while I read it. Acts chapter 9 and verse 32 is where we're going to start reading, and we'll read the first part of the passage together. Acts chapter 9, verse 32 says this: "As Peter travelled about the country, he went to visit the saints in Lydda. And there he found a man named Aeneas, a paralytic who had been bedridden for 8 years. Aeneas, Peter said to him, 'Jesus Christ heals you. Get up and tidy your mat.' Immediately, Aeneas got up, and all who lived in Lydda and Sharon saw him and turned to the Lord." Okay, well, we're going to stop there because we've already found two people that we can talk about. And the first person, most obviously, is Peter, because we read about him in the first verse. And, you know, we read an awful lot about Peter in the New Testament, but we read something really quite interesting in the passage that we just read, because we find that it says that as Peter travelled about the country. Now, Peter was travelling about the country going to visit Christians, going to visit the saints. What's so special about that, you might say? Well, let's think a little bit more about Peter. Peter, he used to be a fisherman, didn't he? He had a nice, steady job where he'd get up in the morning or maybe in the evening, whatever time of the day was best for fishing. He'd go out in his boat and he'd be home for tea and he'd be there and he'd have his family around. Because Peter had a family, don't forget, right? We know that Peter had a wife because he had a mother-in-law, because Jesus heals a mother-in-law. And it's really difficult to have a mother-in-law if you haven't got a wife, okay? So we know that Peter was married. We don't know for sure that Peter had children because the Bible doesn't mention his children anywhere. Traditionally, people have said that he had a daughter called Petronella. Who knows? He might have had other children as well. So he had a wife, probably had a daughter. I had a mother-in-law, so he had family. Now, you know, just have you thought a little bit about the implications for his family of Peter just giving up his nice quiet life, going out fishing, and instead roaming the country, visiting other Christians? Well, we know that he had to drag his wife along with him, and we don't know what she thought about that, because the Apostle Paul, in one place, in 1 Corinthians, he says, Paul's talking about himself, and he says, "Don't we have the right to take a believing wife along with us? As do the other apostles and the Lord's brothers and Cephas, Peter." So Peter used to take his wife traveling with him. So, you know, he dragged his poor wife from this comfortable, you know, living happily in her little fishing community with all her friends and her mother-in-law around the corner, or her mother around the corner, and so on, into being dragged up and down, living out of a suitcase, and getting tired feet and so on. And it's, you know, what we can learn from Peter is that sometimes doing God's work is hard work. And sometimes you end up having to make sacrifices for it. Paul said when he was writing to Timothy, "Whoever aspires to be an overseer desires a noble task." And the word noble, I looked it up. I got a great old Strong's Concordance that my grandfather gave me once that believed belonged to a famous Scottish preacher. And I opened it up and I found that in my Strong's Concordance that the noble task of being an elder is something that's praiseworthy, that's beautiful by reason of purity of heart. It's morally good, it's honourable. And I don't think that's restricted purely to the work of God of being an overseer. This is someone who is dedicating their lives to doing God's work, and they're doing something that is morally good, honourable, beautiful, praiseworthy. Praiseworthy. Do we give praise and thanks to the people in this church, in my church, who are doing God's work? know, I'm sure that there's no one here who works hard, and many of you slog hard working for God in this community. And I know you don't do it to be thanked by people like me or by others in the church, but it is good to be thanked. And I think that those of you, and there are many of you, who are working hard for the gospel, like Peter did, you deserve to be thanked and to be praised because you're doing what's good and right and honourable. And it's difficult, and you've got to sacrifice, and sometimes your family life suffers. But it's for the Lord, and it makes it worthwhile. A good, honourable, noble task that Peter's doing, going up and down the country, visiting the saints. But when he got there, he found a man named Aeneas, and we read the story, who was bedridden. He was unable to walk, he was paralysed, and he'd been bedridden for 8 years, and Peter speaks to him and says, Jesus Christ heals you, and immediately Aeneas gets up and walks. A great healing. What do we learn from that great healing? Well, while I was reading what we could learn about this great healing, I discovered that Spurgeon, yeah, you're Baptists here, aren't you? So you all know Spurgeon. I'm not a Baptist by upbringing, so I don't know much about him. But Spurgeon, the great Baptist preacher, on the 16th of July, he preached to it, 6,000 people on this passage, actually, in the Metropolitan Tabernacle in London. And I loved the directness. I read his sermon on the passage. And he says, this is about salvation, okay? Aeneas is a metaphor for what we're like as humans and what God can do to us. What do I mean by that? Well, let's start off. Right, Aeneas, he was definitely sick, right? There was no doubt about it. He'd been lying in a bed for 8 years. There was something wrong with him. And the natural human condition is that we are spiritually sick. There's something wrong with us. We're deficient before God. We're not morally upright. We fall short of God's standards. And just as Aeneas was physically sick, then the way that we are when we're born into the world is we're sick. We're spiritually sick. We might not recognize that sickness, but that's what we are. But the next thing about Aeneas is that he believed on the Lord Jesus. Now, how do I know that he believed on the Lord Jesus? Well, let's think a little bit about this. Aeneas, he was lying in amongst a pile of people on a mat, and he was unable to move. And Peter says to him, Jesus Christ has healed you, get up. Now, at this point, Aeneas has got a choice. He can try and get up, or he can stay lying down. Now, what's the pros and the cons? Now, you know, hey, his condition of not being able to walk is humiliating enough, you know? I mean, we're in a society which is sympathetic towards disabled people. But that's not so much the case here in Roman society. You know, people would have, you know, as the disciples did at one time, been thinking, well, this is something that he did. Maybe he's morally deficient in some way. Perhaps this is punishment from God that he can't walk. And if he were to try and get to his feet, and then just as he was about to stand, his legs buckle underneath him and he collapses and falls away again, then his humiliation would have been that much worse. So he's got the chance. Does he just carry on as he is? In which case, Peter looks like an idiot if nothing happens. Or does he try and get to his feet and stand? In which case, Aeneas looks like an idiot if nothing happens. What does he do? He believes in Jesus and he stands. And unless we believe in Jesus, then we will stay sick. If he hadn't believed in Jesus, he would have been lying on his bed until the day that he died. But faith in Jesus is able to save us from the state that we're naturally in. But the next thing we can see about Aeneas is this. He was made completely whole. He was completely healed. He got up immediately. It doesn't say that gradually over the course of the next 2.5 years, then Aeneas gradually learned to walk again. He got up, right? You know, this is just like the man that Peter had healed. It's about outside the temple where he went walking and leaping and praising God. You know, Aeneas got up. He could walk around. It was immediate and dramatic. And that's the transformation that God can make in your life. You believe in him and he can change you completely and make you completely whole immediately. But, and this is the great thing about is having been made whole, he went away and lived his life in accordance with what had happened to him, right? So Aeneas didn't just say, oh, that's great, I can walk. But you know, that's terribly inconvenient, because now I can walk, I've now got to go get a job instead of begging, which actually might have been easier. He might have got used to it, you know? He'd learned to live with the humiliation, and at least when he was begging, then people would have just given him some food for nothing. Now he's got to get up and go and make a life for himself. But more than that, he goes away, he makes a life for himself, and he tells everyone what God's done for him, and all those, not just most of those, not even many of them, but all of those who lived in Lydda and Sharon saw him and turned to the Lord. So God's healed him. What does he do? He goes out and tells everyone. So what happens to you? God's healed you, and what do? You go out and tell someone, right? That's what it's about. So we've got Aeneas, as Spurgeon so rightly pointed out, a metaphor for the Christian life. A man who was truly sick, who believed on the Lord Jesus, was made whole and went away and lived his life in the good of what God had done for him. Hey, let's make sure we do that. Whichever point in that journey you're in, make sure you get to the next one until you're at the end and telling people all about what God's done for you. It was a church with a heart for evangelism, and the power of Aeneas' testimony was able to bring people to the Lord. Well, I told you we'd learn about four people, and that's two, so we've got another two to go. So let's carry on reading, and we're in verse 36. And it says this. In Joppa, there was a disciple named Tabitha, which when translated is Dorcas, who was always doing good and helping the poor. About that time, she became sick and died, and her body was washed and placed in an upstairs room. Lydda was near Joppa. So when the disciples heard that Peter was in Lydda, they sent two men and urged him, please come at once. Peter went with them. And when he arrived, he was taken upstairs to the room, and all the widows stood around him, crying and showing him the robes and other clothing that Dorcas had made while she was still with them. And Peter sent them all out of the room, and then got down on his knees and prayed. And turning towards the dead woman, he said, Tabitha, get up. She opened her eyes. And seeing Peter, she sat up. He took her by the hand, and he helped her to her feet. And then he called the believers and the widows and presented her to them alive. This became known all over Joppa. I'm not quite sure why it was necessary for Luke, when he was writing Acts, to say this became known all over Joppa. Because I can't imagine that somebody being raised from the dead would be anything other than known all over Joppa. But this became known all over Joppa, and many people believed in the Lord. And Peter stayed in Joppa for some time with a tanner named Simon. And what are we going to learn from this story about Tabitha or Dorcas, whatever we want to call her, whether we want to give her a Greek name or a Hebrew name? Well, you know, first of all, what I'd say is this, is everybody knows a bit of a Dorcas character or a Tabitha character. You know, Peter was the hyperactive elder who was going around, sort of going up and down the length and breadth of the country, helping the church. And Dorcas was, in the very best sense of the word, because we sometimes use the word do-gooder in a bit of a pejorative sense, so we don't mean it in a particularly flattering way. We use it to mean somebody who shoves their nose into other people's business or whatever. But Dorcas was, in the very best sense of the word, the hyperactive do-gooder. She'd been made whole by Jesus, and she acted accordingly, a bit like we've been thinking already. And so she spent her time doing good and helping the poor, making clothes for them and so on like that. And, you know, as I say, we all know a Dorcas or a Tabitha. I remember one woman who, she was the wives of one of the elders in the church that I went to when I was in university down in Swansea. An incredible woman, and she had seven boys, and you'd think that that was enough for and she and her husband both worked full time, so you'd think that having seven boys and a full time job was enough work for anyone. But every Sunday morning, then any students or any waifs and strays like me who turned up at the church were immediately invited round to lunch for Sheila Davis's for lunch. And so every Sunday, then I would descend on the Davises and eat them out of house and home. And sometimes there'd be half a dozen, maybe even 10 of my friends along as well, because it didn't matter how many of us turned up at church, we were all welcome. And you know, if there wasn't enough food to go round, then we'd sort of finish off lunch by eating the communion bread and dipping it in our gravy, because it was important for people to be made to feel welcome. Now, that in itself sounds like it was enough, but every Sunday evening, then there was a big youth meeting in the church they went to, and people used to come from loads of other churches around to go to that church, and there'd normally be about 60, 70, 80 sort of teenagers. And, of course, the Davises lived right next to the church, so what happened? 60 or 70 people used to descend on their house every Sunday evening and eat all their biscuits and drink all their tea and coffee and disrupt the place until sort of 11 o'clock at night. And if you think that that's bad enough, we used to do the same thing again on a Friday. How on earth did this woman cope? It's no wonder she didn't do any housework. She didn't have any time to do any housework, and the house was as untidy as you might expect. But the amount that I learned, and the amount that I learned from just talking to her, but seeing the way that she loved and cared for others, was incredible. And people like that make a mark in your life. And she's made a huge mark in my life. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking to you about her 25 years on, would I? And, you know, sometimes when we are doing what we know we ought to do for God, it's easy for us to just not realize how much of an impact that can have on other people. And the Tabithas, or Dorcases, whatever name you prefer for her, in this church are people who are making a mark on the next generation of Christians. Really, really important people. The thing we learn about Tabitha here is that sometimes bad things can happen to good people. And she was a good person, but something bad happened to her, and she died. Godliness doesn't guarantee a good life. Godliness doesn't guarantee health. Godliness doesn't guarantee money. Godliness doesn't guarantee success. Godliness doesn't guarantee friends. Godliness doesn't guarantee that you won't be lonely. Godliness doesn't guarantee that you won't be unhappy. These things, sometimes bad things can happen to good people. And Dorcas died, as did many people in the New Testament. If they hadn't died, they'd still be here with us today, and you'd be welcoming the Apostle Paul to come and preach on a Sunday morning instead of having to put up with me. And of course, she died, as she did again eventually, because, you know, she was Jesus, through Peter, raised her from the dead here. But again, she did die again eventually. So being good didn't exempt her from suffering. Now, from Peter's point of view, seeing somebody who died and knowing that God was able to raise him from the dead is something that he was quite familiar with. He'd witnessed Jesus raise people from the dead on three occasions. Of course, there was the widow of Nain's son, who isn't named, neither is his mother, just known as a widow from Nain. There was Jairus' daughter, and there was Lazarus. So Jesus had raised three people from the dead. What we probably think about a bit less often is that Peter had probably actually raised someone from the dead before, but we don't know who. What makes me say such a radical thing as that? Well, in Matthew, then Jesus sent the disciples out and he said this: as you go, proclaim this message. The kingdom of heaven has come near. Heal those who are ill, raise the dead, and cleanse those who have leprosy and drive out demons. So Peter had previously been sent out by Jesus with the express command of raising the dead. Now, unless Jesus gave a meaningless command to his disciples, I have to conclude that probably at least one of the disciples had gone out and raised someone from the dead. So this was something that Peter was familiar with, extraordinary though it might seem. And so Peter, seeing the dead woman Dorcas, he does what he ought to do. He prays. What does he pray? Well, we don't know, because the Bible doesn't tell us exactly what he prayed. So people have kind of speculated and tried to think about it, and most commentators are agreed that actually what Peter is praying is he's asking God what God's will is. Because, you know, sad though it might seem, God did not want all dead Christians raised from the dead. If that had happened, then, you know, when Paul had died, then Peter would have prayed over him and he'd have risen, he'd have come back to life, you know? And when Peter had died, then Paul would have prayed, and they would have just been praying for each other, and all those early Christians would still be with us. Most times when people die, then God wanted them dead for a reason. Although, however hard that might have been. But on this occasion, then Peter receives a word from the Lord saying, no, I want to do something different with Dorcas. I want to show my power. I want to show that I am the Lord of life and of death. And so Peter prays. God gives him clear direction, and he immediately acts on the commandment of God, which is to reach out and speak to the dead woman. And God gave him clear direction, and he acted. And God worked. And many people believed. You know, the testimony, and this is, surely this is why God wanted Tabitha raised from the dead. It was so that people could see in that community, that see for themselves the power of God to change lives. And so they believed in Jesus. And of course, they believed because they realized that Peter hadn't done the healing at all. Peter had been present at the healing, but he hadn't done the healing. God had done the healing, not him. But, you know, before we move on from Tabitha or Dorcas, then I just want to say that just like I think that Aeneas is a metaphor for salvation, I think that Tabitha is a metaphor for how we can sometimes become as Christians. A bit of a metaphor for the human condition. What do I mean by that? I don't know if you've ever read any George Herbert. George Herbert was a... Oh, someone has? Great, I'm glad that we've got someone here who appreciates 17th century poetry. George Herbert was a poet and a Christian. Most of his writing is about his faith. Several hundred years old, so sometimes is the wording of what he writes can seem a little bit arcane and so on. But he wrote one poem called The Flower. And in The Flower, then... George Herbert sort of gives us this idea. He says the Christian can become a bit like an overwintering daffodil. Okay? You know what happens to daffodils, don't you, right? Because, I mean, hey, the national flower of Wales. So you if you don't know what happens to daffodils, you need to learn. But, you know, daffodils, they in the winter, then there's nothing of them. There's just like a brown, shriveled up bulb. It looks like a bit like a small onion, right? And it just sort of, you know, there's no signs of life at all. It lives under the ground, out of sight. Nobody can see it. It's just kind of hardly there. And then come the springtime, then the leaves come up, don't they? And the sun starts shining, and the thing grows, and it's vigorous, and it's strong, and beautiful flowers come out, and there are few better things than, as Wordsworth said, a field of golden daffodils. And George Herbert says, well, sometimes, you know, I as a Christian become like that overwintering daffodil. All the signs of life, of Christian life, have disappeared from me. It shouldn't be like that. It shouldn't be like that. But it's a statement of what it's like. Sometimes the life just falls away and you feel like there's nothing left. You're just like a shriveled up little bulb hiding underneath the ground. But the thing about an overwintering daffodil is that it's not dead. It just looks dead. And so what George Herbert says in his thing, he says, who would have thought that my shriveled heart could have recovered greenness? But it can. And just as you might have thought that there was no hope for Dorcas, or her friends would have thought there was no hope for her, but Peter raised her from the dead, you might feel that spiritually there's no hope for you because you're in a difficult, dark spiritual place and you've lost the joy that you once had. And the joy of knowing knowing the Lord and time spent in his presence and all those signs of the spiritual life that you once enjoyed might have gone. And you might think, how can my shriveled heart ever recover greenness? But just as God can raise Dorcas from the dead, God can raise your shriveled heart from its apparent death. And he wants to bring you back to spiritual life. Great are thy wonders, Lord of love, was what George Herbert had to say when he realized that God could bring him back to that position that he once knew. And we Christians can almost die, but the sun is shining. And you can spell the sun with an O as well as a U if you want. The sun is shining and spring's approaching. Wake up. He wants to make you alive in him, just as he made Dorcas alive. So, we've thought about Peter, the elder. We've thought about Aeneas, the metaphor for salvation. We thought about Dorcas, the one who did good and who can speak to us about how God can recover us to our former spiritual condition. Who have I missed out? Who else was in the passage that I mentioned? Simon the Tanner. And he's easily overlooked. He's like a footnote. And for me, right, Simon the Tanner is probably the single most important person in this passage, right? And we're going to find out why in the last few minutes that we've got available to us. The reason that it's easy for us to overlook Simon the Tanner is because we don't know much about tanners. So I need to explain to you. We read that at the end, Peter stayed in Joppa for some time with a tanner named Simon. Now, what's the importance of a tanner? Well, a tanner, of course, in case you don't know what the word means, a tanner is somebody who makes leather. Okay, so, and the process of making leather is something that kind of, for us now, happens in factories, in nice clean industrial complexes, and we don't get involved in the mess of it. But tanning was a bit of a messy business in Roman times. The first thing you had to do was find a carcass, okay? And collect together a few carcasses, and people will have eaten the meat, but you've got the skins, and so you'll have a big pile of carcasses in the corner of your yard, and you can imagine the smell and the flies as the sun starts shining on them. So the carcasses in themselves, in the first place, are not that great. But the next thing you have to do is scrape away all the gore, because there's going to be, you know, little bits of meat and fat clinging to them, and you've got to get there with a knife on your bare hands and just start scraping it away, and you're going to get covered with blood and covered with dead animal parts. And this is before people have invented hot showers, okay? So it's going to be hard to clean up afterwards, and it's going to go all over your clothes, and you haven't got washing machines. But, you know, apart from that, hey, no problem, because the worst is yet to come. So once you've scraped away the gore, you've now got to start working out how you're going to take this animal skin and turn it into leather. And that process of tanning means that you've got to try and do some preserving. And the best thing to preserve animal hides, I'm afraid, is, well, we've got three things. We've got a few things we want. First thing that you need to do is you need to send out some of the local village kids to go and collect the bedpans from people in the village and collect the urine and all the pots of frothy yellow liquid, and you pour it together and you soak your skins in the urine and you leave it there for a few months and you let it putrefy, and no, it doesn't smell very good. Okay, and then after you've left it to putrefy for a few months, you then take it back out, and then you scrape all the hair off. And as you do that with a knife, you can imagine the hairs flying around everywhere and going all over you and all over your clothes, together with all the urine that the little boys have collected from the village for you. And then, I told you it gets even worse than that, because what you then have to do is to send those boys back out to collect a whole load of feces. Human and dog is best, because it's more powerful than most. And you spread that all over the leather with your bare hands, and you trample it in with your bare feet for several hours. The other thing that's particularly effective at this point is to take some mashed brains, okay? So you mash some brains up and trample that into the hide as well. And And you do that for 2 or 3 hours. And if you've got any leftover skin after this process, then you leave any leftover skin and you leave it to rot in water for 2 or 3 months, and you boil it for hours until you've made glue, because that's quite a valuable commodity as well. So as you can imagine, tanneries don't smell good. Tanners don't smell good. In fact, they weren't allowed in most towns. They were usually built outside the town and definitely downwind, okay? Because you don't want the smell. Tanners literally stank. And as well as that, if you were a Jew, tanners were unclean. Because all of this handling of, you know, some dead flesh and so on, then they were spiritually unclean. So some good Orthodox Jews wouldn't have had anything to do with them. So that's a tanner. Now put yourself in Peter's position. He's in Joppa. He's just raised a woman from the dead. And people are believing in Jesus all over the place. Who is the most prestigious guest that you can have in Joppa? It's Peter, right? The whole town would have been clamoring to have Peter to stay with him. So Peter's got the choice. Where do I stay? You know, in this nice fine house over here in the middle of town? Do I stay with that really friendly couple over there? Or do I stay with Peter, the unclean tanner, outside the town, downwind, where it stinks? So guess what Peter does? He goes and stays with Simon the tanner. Why does he do that? He stays there for some time, amongst the rotting carcasses, amongst the urine, amongst the dung, amongst the mashed brains. He must have had better offers. And you know, what I think we can learn from this is this. It's easy to love a Dorcas. Everybody loves the Sheila Davises of this world, right? Because they're there helping people. But some Christians are rather less lovable than others. Some are a bit like the tanner. If they don't smell physically, maybe there's a bit of a reek about their character that you're not very keen on. And we all have Christians that give us a problem. Maybe you've got Christians in this church that give you a problem. Maybe they're Christians from some other place. Maybe they're a relative or an associate. Maybe it's me. Maybe you can't stand me. Perhaps you wouldn't have come this morning if you knew it. Maybe you didn't know I was preaching, and that's why you came. Why? And perhaps they've hurt you. Perhaps they infuriate you. Perhaps you just don't find much evidence of Christ in them. But Peter found it in him to go and stay with the most unpleasant, awkward place in town, the unclean place, the smelly place, the place where people wouldn't want to visit him, the place that wasn't even in the town because it was downwind, the place amongst the dead bodies and the carcasses and the stink. And God wants you to be a Peter. Whoever your Simon the Tanner is, the person that you'd really rather not know, God wants you to be a Peter to them and to show them the love of God the way that Peter was prepared to show the love of God to an unpleasant tanner. They're God's child. Jesus died for them. And if they're good enough for God, they should be good enough for you or for me.